Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the 2019 series of Gifford Lectures. I'm Alison Elliott, I'm an Honorary Fellow in the School of Divinity and I'm a member of the Gifford Lectures Committee. I'm delighted to welcome our distinguished speaker for this evening, Professor Dame Mary Beard, Professor at the University of Cambridge and Fellow of Newnham College, as she continues her series on the theme, The Ancient World and Us, From Fear and Loathing to Enlightenment and Ethics. In her first three lectures, Professor Beard has explored how it is that we can understand people in the ancient world who are both very similar to us, but also quite different in their culture and attitudes. She's looked at the apparent pleasure they took in murderous games, the puzzle of colour, and the politics of sexual violence. This evening, in the fourth of her lectures, she turns her attention to us and them, various forms of exclusion and inclusion in the ancient world. The lecture and the questions this evening are being recorded, and the video will shortly be available on the University's Gifford Lectures web pages. I have now great pleasure in handing over to Professor Mary Beard.
Thank you. Thanks very much, everybody. I'm really pleased to be back. I want to start this week's lectures with an aspect of the ancient world that we regularly admire, right? We've had three lectures so far on some decidedly questionable topics: gladiators, rape, the modern whitewashing of diversity in the ancient world. And I thought we perhaps needed a change. So I'm going to kick off this time with the gleaming and unsullied case study of classical Athenian democracy. Though I might as well warn you, it's going to emerge a bit more solid than you perhaps hoped. I also have to confess that I've slightly reconfigured the elements in this and the next lecture. So if you've been studying the lecture descriptions, I have to confess that democracy won't be half of my theme tomorrow, though I will be looking, as promised, at tyranny then and empire. I apologise if that ruins it for anybody, but I'm afraid it's a consequence of writing the descriptions of the lectures before you've written the lectures. Okay. Yeah, it's still called us and them. It goes without saying, I think, that the one man, one vote system of popular government, and I mean one man, quite literally, that was devised or took shape in Athens from the 6th through to the 5th century BC, is now almost universally seen to be one of the ancient world's bright spots. Right? It's not just a system of direct democracy in which all of the city's major decisions were taken by a popular vote of the citizens. But structures were in place to ensure that the rich elite, the old Etonians of the Athenian world, should not be able to dominate the political process or what we might call the executive. So, for example, seats on the city council and most of the annual officials, most, not all, were selected randomly by lot. What you see on the screen now is a 19th century German attempt to encapsulate this glorious image, combining a kind of wonderful idealized scene of an Athenian public meeting. Though actually they're rather happily, they're not all dressed yet. It's only Pericles who's dressed in a white sheet. Everybody else looks quite bright. And it's got hints of the art and culture that we like to think flourished in Athens precisely because it was a democracy. I don't quite know how this lady here has slipped into this public meeting, because she certainly doesn't belong. I think she must be the artist's model. It is, of course, a very dodgy principle that good government makes good art, but it's an idea that has often and still goes strong in reference to Athens. There was, fascinatingly, an exhibition of 5th century BC Greek art in Washington, D.C. in 1992-3 that was built around exactly that point. And as if to underline the fact, there was an introduction in the catalogue of the exhibition written by George Bush the First himself. And there are some of his wise words on Athenian democracy and its heritage in the West. I shall be coming back to some of these wise or not so wise words in my last lecture. Now, this admiration of Greek, by which we really mean Athenian democracy, hasn't by any means always been the rule. In fact, it's only really been the case that there's been this widespread admiration for less than a couple of centuries. I mean, your own local attempt to build a tribute to it was actually one of the earliest examples. Before that, before the early 19th century, you would not have found anywhere in the West, I think, many people who admired universal male suffrage, leaving women out of the picture entirely. And the more moderate quasi-democracy of the Roman Republic, whose foundations, as we saw in a couple of weeks ago, was marked by the rape of Lucretia and the suicide of Lucretia, it was the moderate quasi-democracy of the Roman Republic that always then seemed a rather more judicious model, which is, of course, why George Bush's own Washington has got a Capitol Hill and a Senate and so forth. They were literally seeing themselves in a Roman, not a Greek, image. But now it really is Athenian democracy, different as it was in many ways from our own. It's now Athenian democracy that we see, as Bush kind of was capitalising on, as taking a foundational role in our political family tree. Now, there are some good things about that, I think, and I would be the first to say that engaging and looking hard at this early democratic system can usefully undermine some of our own sloppy certainties about how the power of the people really works. I think, for example, that looking hard at ancient Athenian discussions of democracy, which I'll come back to again in a bit, usefully challenges the limitations of our own discussions of democracy. It's a highly appropriate week to be talking about this. because we, I think, it gets more relevant, I'm sorry, we, I think, really have begun to reduce the democratic process to not much more than voting. And it's summed up, I fear, by this kind of slightly self-congratulatory picture that sometimes decorates the front pages of British newspapers, showing often Afghan women in burqas putting a voting paper into a ballot box. Now, I'm not for a minute suggesting that in some ways this kind of image is not uplifting. Of course, it is. But the Athenian debates remind us that there is a lot more to democracy than voting wherever you are in the world, including here, as we, I think, are finding right now. Athenian writers, critics, and analysts rightly focus just as strongly as on the act of voting on the question of how people made up their minds what to vote, what information, what reliable information they had on which to base that vote, and who persuaded them to vote which way, and by what means, legitimate or others. And if this doesn't sound too egregiously topical, it's worth noting, just as a point of information, because it's being so such a lot of fake news is about around this, it is worth pointing out that the Athenians were quite happy to vote on the same issue twice in quick succession, right? There is a classic case of this, which I want everybody to remember if they don't already know about it, because it's wonderful ammunition. It comes in 427 BC when the town of Mytilene on the island of Lesbos tried to break away from what was then an Athenian empire. In retribution, the Athenian assembly came together and they voted to kill all the adult men and to enslave all the women and children. The next morning, they woke up and they thought, oh, what have we done? Oh, my God. Know the feeling, right? And they convened another assembly and they voted instantly to overturn their first decision. And luckily, the ship which had been dispatched to carry out decision number one was going so slowly because of what the news it was taking that the second ship carrying decision number two easily overtook it and saved their day. Now, there are reasons, bad and good, for having a second referendum. But the fact that changing your mind is not written into the deep history of democracy is not one of them. Okay, back to the topic. That's the last bit. Couldn't resist. This admiration of Athenian democracy, however, and I'm a victim of that admiration a bit, does come at the cost of a large number of blind spots in a modern discussion and kind of modern sort of popular representations of Athenian democracy. In order to find a nice ancient democratic ancestor for ourselves, however remote it is, we have to choose not to see quite a lot about ancient Athens and about ourselves. For a start, the very idea that came out very strongly in the Washington DC exhibition in the 90s, the very idea that classical Athens was the world's first democracy, is one of the worst self-serving misrepresentations that Western civilization has been responsible for. It was the first political system to call itself a democracy, that's for sure. Demokratia is a Greek word, and that's why it was the first demokratia, right? Okay. But there may well have been proto-political systems of a similar kind operating in other parts of the West before the age of Athenian democracy. We simply don't know. But we do know that there were very early egalitarian and participatory political traditions in parts of the East that were effectively democratic from at least the time of the Athenian democracy, even though we don't recognise them or call them as such. I think we should do well to remember that inventing the word democracy, which the Athenians certainly did, is a very different thing from inventing democratic practice, which they almost certainly didn't. But even if we stick to a Greek version of demokratia here, there's an awful lot that in our casual discussions, television programmes and so forth, about that system that simply gets brushed under the carpet to give us the slightly gooey, virtuous image of Athenian democracy that somehow we want as our ancestor. It is not often pointed out, for example, that of the 1,000 or so independent cities in the classical Greek world, only a minority were termed or termed themselves democratic. There's well under 100 that we know of for certain, though probably there were a few more than that. The one we know by far the best is Athens. But strikingly, it's worth remembering that even here, almost all the evidence discussing its democracy from the inside in ancient literature comes from well-heeled writers who are virulently or mildly opposed to democracy as a system. Seeing it, sorry, this is not meant to be, yes, I'm not going back to Brexit. Seeing it as a recipe for bad decision making and what people in the 19th century used to call mob rule. So far as we can see, it wasn't that kind of prized possession of the 5th century Athenians that they all loved. So far as we can see, the idea of democracy in the supposed glory days of 5th century Athens, which is what you've got on screen, was always deeply contested, and it was anything but gooey. There were coups in Athens, attempted counter coups, there were political assassination, and there was a lively, to put it mildly, oligarchic political opposition who supported the rule of the few, the oligoi, not the people as a whole. And these guys would have been quite happy to betray the city to its great enemies, the Persians, if they could have actually got rid of democracy in the process. So dominant, really, is the opposition to, or the non-support of democracy in the contemporary written record, that we actually have no intellectual manifesto for ancient Athenian democratic politics at all. We have to reconstruct what they thought they were doing by looking at what the opponents said and looking at what the institutions seemed to suggest was the function and the purpose of all this. So we haven't got a very, very hazy bit of ideology, which is quite hard to reach. But also how it all worked in practice is also much more ragged at the edges and a bit less glorious than the sort of rosy-tinted image you see here tends to suggest. First of all, the number of Athenian citizens we're dealing with in this democracy is small. Now, I'm sure you can guess that the exact figures are a real academic battleground. But it would not be uncontroversial to say that the total number of male citizens in the mid-5th century BC was in the 30 to 40,000 range, which is about the same number as the students of this university, right? Now, it's easy to have a democracy when you're this size, right? But even then, they were worried, like we are, about low turnouts. And it seems that a combination of various forms of compulsion to attend the voting assemblies, and eventually, this is carrot and stick approach, pay as a reward for doing so. Great. I think pay as a reward for voting is a great idea. That was needed to get, it appears, the average Athenian participating in this active direct democracy on a regular basis. And in terms of social mobility, it was actually very rare for any ordinary bloke, leave aside the women, ever to reach a real position of influence in the city. It was, and we're familiar with this, overwhelmingly rich men from elite families who competed for the few elected offices there still were, rather than those selected by lot. And they looked down their nose at other people who attempted to be the leaders of the community. They looked down their nose at others as if they were interlopers. And the comic dramas of the 5th century are full of snide and appallingly snobbish jokes about the nouveau riche who tried to break into politics. You know, makes the Bullingdon Club look tame if you read Aristophanes. And then, of course, there were the big exclusions. You may be surprised that so far I've only alluded rather gently to the fact that there were no women in this boys' political club, nor, of course, any slaves, of which there were many in Athens. Now, the usual modern procedure in talking about this here is not unlike what I pointed to in my lecture on gladiators. You start off in your book or your article by deploring the exclusions, right? Women were not included, slaves were not included. Then you park the problem over to one side and proceed with your analysis as if that deploring had never happened. They didn't exist. Now, it goes against the grain, I have to say, for me to say this, but I think that there are... I think that's a more understandable procedure for women than slaves, and I will explain why. I should be coming really to focus on slaves as the excluded, after I've just had a quick look at the women. Athenian culture throughout counted women out, as it were. And I think you can see that nicely encapsulated if you look, paradoxically, at the image of Athens's patron goddess. Now, I put on the screen here the most stunning, or perhaps the most revolting, reconstruction we have of the great gold and ivory statue of the patron goddess Athena, who once stood in the Parthenon. Happily, it has been destroyed. But it has been reconstructed along with the Parthenon itself in Nashville, Tennessee, which is where this is, and it's really worth a visit. It really gives you that kind of sense of what it might have been like to be there. As I said, paradoxically, perhaps, this statue of a female deity points better than almost anything else at the marginalisation of real women in the community. The goddess, in some ways, is everything that the Athenian women were not supposed to be. First of all, she's a virgin goddess, when the duty of the citizen woman, was first and foremost and almost exclusively to bear children. She is kitted up in rather peculiar military dress when that dress is the exclusive prerogative of men, except for the appallingly transgressive race of female Amazon warriors, but they get slaughtered. And I think, you know, we look at this and you see a woman with a shield and a spear and a helmet and a breastplate here, and she's carrying a victory. And to us, I think that that looks just a bit odd, right? It's kind of, you know, there's lots of things about classical art that look a bit odd, and this is one of them. I think what you have to see in ancient terms, that looking at that in the middle of the 5th century BC was about as arresting and hold your breathing as seeing now the image of a 5-year-old with a Kalashnikov. You know, it's a real clash of different different forms, male and female. It's also the case, as is represented on the sculpture in the gable of the Parthenon and on lots of ceramics that you see here, that Athena herself was not born from a woman, but she was born directly from the head of her father, Zeus. The obstetric details are clearest here. The sculptor of the Parthenon frieze is rather, you know, cheated by having that's Athena and that's Zeus, and you know, all of the childbirth is long gone when we see that. Now, what this means, again, it just seems a bit odd, you know, Athena's born from the head of Zeus, so what, you know? Another bit of weird Greek mythology. But essentially what's going on here is everything the city's patron goddess stands for is the kind of wishful fantasy of the misogyny of Athenian men, in which you can imagine a world without women. You know, that women are not necessary for bearing children. Does not actually have, you know, she does not have a mother. And they do things. You can not see the female principle. You rely on it, But what your patron goddess tells you is that somehow, in the world, the ideal world of myth, things work differently without women. Now, it does seem to me essential that you always have to understand the politics of Athens against that kind of background of cultural masculinity. Never mind the fact women couldn't vote, they weren't part of the citizen body in that kind of way. But I'm not sure, and this is where I feel a bit of a coward, that a constant return to the absence of women in the Athenian polity helps much in getting to grips with the nature of the democracy. Slavery, however, and enslaved people have a completely different and absolutely integral role to play here, not just as a kind of background of discrimination. One uncomfortable fact that we tend to draw a veil over, really, is that Athens, and to some extent I'll be coming onto this, Rome too, in Athens, slavery went ideologically hand in hand, joined at the hip with the democratic polity of the free citizen. There is a characteristic triangulation going on here, as I put it in its crudest form in this diagram, between free citizens, democratic politics, and the enslaved or the excluded other. That's to say, the other side of democracy, the essential other side of democracy, I'm going to claim, is enslavement. I mean enslavement or slavery of a particular type. So far as we can tell, the ancient world was full of a whole mosaic of various forms of non-free or not entirely free statuses going back as far as you can possibly see, the beginning of humanity. People, for example, who'd fallen into debt, become the bondsmen, dependents of their creditors and so forth. Now, I'm not really talking about that whole range, but I'm talking particularly about the mechanism of chattel slavery, where the enslaved person is the direct property or chattel of their master and could be bought and sold just like any other piece of property. The indebted bondsman can't be bought and sold. I'm talking about slaves that you can trade. Now, what is absolutely clear is that in Athens, the origins of democracy and the definition of the freedom of the Athenian citizen are part and parcel of the same process as the development of an exclusion and exploitation of slaves and, to some extent, foreigners. It goes back to a revolution in what was admittedly a rather murky part of the early 6th century BC, which did three things crucially simultaneously. It established what appears to have been, or was seen later as, the first democratic institutions of the state. It abolished all forms of debt bondage for free Athenian citizens. So no Athenian citizen could fall into bondage, in that sense, ever again. And at the same time, it defined slavery as the chattel slavery of people who were not Athenian. So it sets up an internal, external definition of freedom and slavery, which go hand in hand and together. An absolute boundary was erected between slaves on the one hand and citizens on the other. And it was a principle of exclusion that lasted and became sharper, actually, in different respects as time went on. And it's a basic rule of thumb, although not a very comfortable one, that the more radically democratic Athens becomes, the more rigidly and exclusively it defines its citizenship, culminating in a decree in 451 BC, which said in order to be, and this has resonances for us, I think, in order to be a citizen of Athens, you had to have both parents who were Athenian citizens. Previously, it had only been a citizen father. Now, it's often said that Athenian democracy relied in practical terms on slaves, and that it would have been impossible for Athenian men to take the time off to do democracy if they hadn't had slaves to do their work for them. And I'm sure that's true. But I think more to the point is that somewhere deep down there, the whole ideological rationale of Athenian freedom and liberty and democracy was based on a division between free Athenians and enslaved or potentially enslaved outsiders. Now, I don't for a minute want to say that the only driver of mass slavery in Athens or in the Greek world in general was the cause of citizen freedom. I've already said that there were different forms of unfreedom that were endemic, and there were also all other kinds of reasons for enslavement, for example, conquest, that I'll be coming back to partly tomorrow. And it's also the case that slavery flourished in societies that were not democracies in Athens, in the Greek world, cultures that put a degree of stress on the citizen, but not necessarily the democratic citizen. But the connections, I want to say, between the liberty of the free and its antitype in slavery were absolutely crucial, and they were also in ancient Rome. Now, Rome's political life, as you might call it, was in many ways very, very different from classical Athens, fundamentally because of a difference of size. I said a moment or two ago that in Athens we're dealing with a citizen body, male citizen body, of 30 to 40,000 in the mid-5th century. That's pretty much the high spot of the Athenian population. By contrast, the population, and here I mean the total population, including women and slaves, of the city of Rome alone, never mind the rest of Italy, by the end of the 1st century BC, was in the region of 1 million. Right? It's the biggest city in the Western world until 19th century London. And in relationship to slavery, too, there was some significant contrasts between Athens and Rome. The most significant was that the Romans regularly liberated, freed their slaves, their domestic slaves, let's say, don't know about those working in the mines or whatever, who, on being given their freedom, became Roman citizens with more or less full citizen rights. Now, there's no reason to think that that was done out of affection. A bigger motive, it might sometimes have been, but a bigger motive may well have been crudely economic, to get rid of a worker who was now not worth the upkeep. Or to put this, I think, uncomfortably crudely, but this is the kind of uncomfortable crudeness that you have to accept in the institutions of ancient slavery. I think getting rid of a slave, freeing a slave, could be the equivalent of getting rid of an old washing machine that had become too expensive to repair, right? It's probably as instrumental and awkward, I think, as that. But whatever the motives for this freedom, and there were no doubt many, it embedded slavery at the heart of Roman society in a rather more complicated way than in Athens. Because of this influx of freed slaves into the citizen body, it's reckoned that by the mid-second century AD, a significant proportion, maybe something between a third and a half, of the citizen population of the city had slavery in their ancestry. So there is that very, very big difference, which was noticed in the ancient world itself. And you see here a snapshot of part of that process. You've got a freeborn Roman man here, between two of his ex-slaves in a perfectly Roman, even if slightly patronising, I think, trio. But there's still something of what I would call the Athenian principle in the Roman case. Because the Romans too, in the 4th century BC, abolished the debt bondage of Roman citizens and defined enslavement as something that happened to others. So if at Rome slaves could become citizens, that's true, citizens, by definition, could never become slaves. Right? Now, what I'm trying to do is to say, look, right at the very heart of these cultures, slavery is absolutely central and embedded. And it's another case where we really have to ask, how could they do it? What stories, what narratives, what explanations, what theorising made it possible for one group of human beings to treat another group with the full backing of the law as effectively subhuman, as, quotes, machines with a voice, as they called it. I think it's robots, human robots. How can we, without actually apparent opposition, I think that's important. If, you know, if you're thinking that there was an abolitionist movement in Rome or Greece, I think forget it, all right? How could this have just gone on being practiced? There might have been individuals who had all things, sorts of things to say about it, but it's absolutely certain there is no communal movement against this. And how can we understand the violence that seems to mark the status of the slave? I mean, it is not a coincidence that some Roman slave names literally meant beat me, right? So you've got a slave, and you call, when you call out, you're calling to beat me, right? And how can you understand, I mean, effectively, I suppose, how it is possible for a whole culture to think that you can treat other human beings as animals? Now, if you can't tell whether this collar originally belonged to a slave or to a dog, that, I think, is the whole point, right? It's got a little thing around it saying, you know, I've run away, there's be a reward if you return me. And you can see that it is equally appropriate, and that's the giveaway for animals or humans. And there were, in this institution, and I'm staying with Rome for a bit, but I'll come back to Athens, I don't think it's any different, there were terrible atrocities, both on the day-to-day level, you know, and you don't need me to tell you what working down an ancient mine as a slave would have been like. But there's also notorious one-off incidents. In 61 AD, for example, when a Roman aristocrat was murdered by one of his slaves, the law took its course. That said that all 400 slaves in the household were to be put to death. If a slave kills a master, all the slaves in the household are killed. That's the way you prevent slaves killing their masters. And for me, it's the old gladiator question again. You know, how could the average Roman bloke who's perfectly decent and loved his dog, you know, sit there all day in the, you know, Colosseum watching that stuff? It's the gladiator question writ large. It raises some similar issues. But it also takes the question on a bit, exposing, I think, rather more clearly some of the cracks in ancient moral certainty, and I shall come to our certainty in the end. So how did the morality of slavery work? Well, to answer that, we need to think a little bit about what we actually know about slaves. I confess I'm feeling a bit hesitant doing that in this university because it has a great tradition of studying slaves and slavery, and I suspect there are people in the audience who know quite a lot more about this than me, so they'll have to forgive me. But again, it is a bit like gladiators. We've got quite a lot of vivid and sometimes nasty evidence, glimpses like the collar on the screen. But at the same time, the big picture the infrastructure and the history of slavery as an institution in any detailed sense is really elusive. In one way, as I've said, unfreedom in the ancient world goes back as far as we can see it. You've got slaves in the Minoan, Mycenaean, Linear B tablets. But we have no clear idea of why the characteristic form of chattel slavery that I've been talking about, with slaves bought and sold as property, why that died out in the early Middle Ages, except to say it's probably got more to do with economics and less to do with Christianity than we might hope. And in some ways, you know, there is a sense in which ancient slavery is a kind of unitary phenomenon in opposition to freedom. But beyond that, even chattel slavery came in many different forms and different conditions. From the utter degradation, I think we have to imagine, of those working in the mines or some agricultural operations, to more domestic settings, which would presumably have been not quite so bad, whether in private houses or family workshops, to indeed relatively powerful positions as the skilled assistants, doctors and secretaries, administrators of Roman aristocrats and emperors, more so in Rome than in Athens, but you could find a similar spread in Athens. Now, there is not much life experience in common between that kind of elite slave, who might themselves have actually owned slaves, because it's that complicated, and the poor souls who were digging in the mines. And in fact, although this again goes against the grain, and I think against our modern liberal gut reaction, I think that I would probably have preferred to have been a slave secretary of, let's say, Cicero or the Emperor Augustus, to someone who was free but unemployed and destitute. Now, ancient writers didn't devote very much attention or concern on the free poor. I think for the very simple reason that the poor were a problem who neatly sold themselves. They died, right? Now, I think it's a... I throw in that fact because I think, again, when we're thinking about our reactions to slavery, of course we deplore it. Of course we're all abolitionists. But I think that you have to reckon that there were some people in the ancient world who were worse off than slaves. And the free destitute probably come into that category. We know even less about them than the slaves because they have no means of support. Again, another non-surprise, I'm sure. As for how many slaves there were altogether, it's a big unknown. And how many families used, had, owned slaves, again, uncertain. It's taken to be pretty much universal. We don't really know. One of the guesses puts the number of slaves in Italy in, say, the first or second centuries AD at about 1.5 million, which would be the quarter of the total population. But again, we don't really know what the total population is, but you know, we've got a big, significant minority of slaves as part of the population. And there are all kinds of unanswerable questions that are raised from this. I mean, like, where do they get them from? I mean, the first generation of slaves come from conquest, almost certainly, and you can see them. Here's a triumphal procession, procession after great Roman victory, and here's two captives. They're being processed along the streets of Rome, but they're going to end up as somebody's slave. It's still, though, a subject of enormous debate. Once the major series of conquests have finished, where you get your slaves from at that number. Is it home breeding? You know, do slaves actually have to reproduce themselves in order to reproduce the master's property. Some may have come from those abandoned babies I mentioned in an earlier lecture, and there are some slaves who have names which say not beat me, but picked up on the rubbish heap, which presumably suggests that was their origin. It's hard not to imagine that there were not as nasty people traffickers operating certainly on the margins of the Roman Empire in the ancient world as there are nasty people traffickers now. But we really don't know. But more than anything, what frustrates the study of slavery, and this goes also for women, of course, is that we have hardly any voice from the slaves themselves. And that makes it very unlike the study of slavery in the American South, where there is considerable slave testimony. There are a handful of surviving authors who are sometimes imagined, on a little bit of evidence, to have been slaves. Perhaps the Roman writer of fables, Phaedrus, perhaps the Roman comic dramatist Terence, or perhaps not. But for the most part, we're always one removed from the voice of the slave, as with the Roman poet Horace, who was the son of an ex-slave. Or we're always finding ourselves on the other end of the conversation, as with this gold bracelet found near Pompeii. It is actually a rather lovely thing, and it is inscribed in Latin with words to the effect of, "This is a present from master to his slave girl." Now, I cannot tell you the soppiness that this brings out in historians who talk about it, right? They say, oh, look, how sweet. Here we've got evidence of a romantic relationship between master and slave. And, oh, God, he's given her this lovely bracelet, right? Well, maybe that is what happened. But I can't help thinking when I read those soppy bits of description, I wonder whether it looked quite like that to the slave girl who had no choice about whether to get into bed with her old slob of a master, even if he'd managed to convince himself it was all wonderfully consensual, right? And that reminds us, don't forget, that slaves were expected to fulfill all duties, and that included sex. Now, it's partly because of this absence of the slave viewpoint that pushes me as a historian to look at the perspective of the owners, even if somehow you think it's morally the victims who deserve our attention. And as I said, it pushes me to the question of how could this institution have been sustained? You know, how could we not find, you know, any kind of vocal abolitionism. Now, one fundamental answer to that, and I guess it's the standard one that you'd have heard from many Greek and Roman intellectuals, was some version of the slave not being a human being, like I was trying to argue the gladiator was not seen as a human being, in the sense of not being a person with agency and rights. I already mentioned one version of that when I referred to one Roman writer seeing slaves as machines with a voice, or in our terms, as I said, robots. It's even more striking what the 4th century Greek philosopher Aristotle had to say when he talked about how you thought about slavery, and he talked about those who were, those slaves were slaves, i.e. subhuman, by nature, right? So he is theorising a category. He found it quite hard because he couldn't deal with people who had been free and then conquered and then became slaves. That was a problem. But what he wanted intellectually was to say that people, those who were slaves, were naturally slaves. And you can find lots of discussions, not quite as acute as Aristotle, but along the same lines in ancient literature. For me, though, the crucial point in these arguments about slaves are machines, slaves are subhuman, slaves are naturally slaves, the crucial point is that those arguments tend to be terribly, terribly ragged at the edges. Now, I mentioned in passing when I was talking in my first lecture about gladiators, that the sense that gladiators weren't really human, which I thought in some way was underpinning the crowd's ability to watch, that sense was always a perilous one. As Cicero said on one occasion, the spectators felt sorry for the elephants who were going to be killed because they seemed to be human. But in the case of slavery, in Roman culture certainly, but also I think you could make the same argument for Athenian, we're dealing, for me, with an enormous fault line in the moral, intellectual, cultural world here. A vast, gaping moral paradox on the question of what freedom and humanity was all about. I'm not talking here about ancient opposition to slavery, I'm talking about ancient anxiety about it. That's to say, on the one hand, as I've said, slavery was ideologically embedded in the definition of free citizenship, and that symbiosis of slave and master was acted out practically on a day-to-day basis. Now, I was struck myself by this on one rather surprising occasion when I took a group of students to a local Roman museum, and in this museum, they had, for kids, a dress-yourself-in-a-toga display, right? A bit like this, but not quite so grand. Now, these students were on a day out that was meant to be intellectual, but they all went and damn well rushed to this and started putting the toga on, which I rather disapproved, until I realised that we had all learnt one very important lesson from this dressing up box, and that is, it is absolutely impossible to put a toga on without help. Togas mean slaves, right? Slightly less playfully, that was, the students never forgot it. Slightly less playfully, it was soon after that incident with the toga that I noticed a particular cruelty of the Emperor Domitian at the end of the first century AD that I hadn't noticed before. Domitian was hosting a dinner party specifically in order to humiliate his guests. And one of those humiliations was that at the end of the dinner, he swapped their slaves round and he sent them home with somebody else's. Now, why was that so terrifying? Why was that so, you know, part of the this whole kind of cruelty of the emperor? I can only understand it in the sense that the civic, citizenly, and personal identity of the freeborn man was forged in his relationship to the enslaved, dehumanized machine with a voice. They kind of go together. Yet on the other hand, what is just as important as those assertions of the symbiosis of slavery and freedom is that it seems to me, and there's evidence for it, that it was impossible to sustain that image of the robot in the everyday life at Rome. Slaves were not like gladiators. They were not on the other side of the representational wall of the Colosseum. They were not a spectacle of dehumanized otherness. They shared your bed, they read to you, they talked as they helped you put on your toga. They were, in some senses, as self-evidently human as you or I. And often, for whatever reason, when they were freed at Rome, they crossed the boundary that kept apart the person from the robot. Interestingly, those 400 slaves that were executed in punishment for just one of their number having murdered their master, we're told, when we told about that, that the ordinary people, when they learnt of the planned punishment in Rome, they rioted in solidarity with the slaves. So you're getting these glimpses of a kind of shared humanity, like Cicero talking about his elephants. And I think it's in response to these huge paradoxes, the question of the slave as human and not human as us and other, that Roman discourse and literature is full of attempts to repackage slave status, to debate and redebate the hierarchies between slave and free, and to cloak the whole institution in a big layer of false consciousness. Now, some of this consists in the kind of banalization we saw with gladiators, or infantilization. Now, those of you who were here a couple of weeks ago may remember these horrible little cupids who are actually gladiators, and you can see their wings here, domesticating gladiatorial combat. Well, something not entirely dissimilar is going on here, and it's a common tactic. The slaves are represented as smaller. This is a dinner party. Here's the guests. The slaves are all little, even the one who is propping up the guy who's puking up here, right? As if the hierarchy of adult to child has been used to translate the hierarchy of free to slave. And it's the same tactic found in the use of the term puer, or boy, to talk to a slave. Or to go back to my French lessons at school, we were taught to address French waiters as garçon. I mean, if you did that, you get into real trouble, but that's how we learned to do it. It's about hierarchy seen in terms of youth and age. But even more strikingly, I think, is the rich literary tradition that faces or reverses or questions the relationship between slave and master, and in individual instances, its morality. It's hard not to suspect that one of the commonest themes in both Greek and Roman comedy, that is, the clever slave who repeatedly outwits the dim master, is some kind of attempt to obscure the real relations of vicious power that are at stake. But just as important are a whole series of anecdotes that focus on the moral, even if not legal, illegitimacy of the master's physical power over the slave, and in a sense, the moral triumph of the slave. The snappiest of these is a story told about the Emperor Hadrian, who is once said to have got into a terrible temper and stabbed a slave in the eye with his pen. He soon did nothing, oh my God, what have I done moment. He felt terrible. And he said to the slave he could choose any gift he wanted. The slave didn't reply. Hadrian pushed him and said, come on, you know, any gift you want. The slave finally just said, I just want my eye back, please. You know, got him in one. Now, I don't for a minute want to let masters off the hook or be seeming to mitigate the whole institution of slavery. As I said, one of the limitations that we have on our understanding of this is that we have almost zero evidence from the slave side. What I'm wanting to stress is that this black spot, and it is a black spot, of institutionalized exploitation, is both absolutely embedded in the culture of the ancient world, so that you could not think Greek or Roman politics without it, and at the same time, it was almost impossible for the ancients to handle. They lived with it, but they failed to make sense of it. Their explanations are always inadequate. What it does, if you're alert to them, is it exposes their own doubts and anxieties. But to finish, I want to say, so what about us? How do we get in here? Well, I think slavery once again brings out the sanctimonious self-righteousness in us all over again. You know, it's the question, would we do that now? Oh, of course we wouldn't. Hey, come on, think again. Do we have slaves? Yes, we do. And even though slave rebellion was actually strikingly rare and interestingly and sometimes puzzlingly rare in antiquity, we still thrill to, you know, the most famous rebel of them all, you know, I am Spartacus, etc., as if it was incumbent on us to side with the rebels, you know, to make ourselves feel better. We're on Spartacus's side. And there's a little bit of that. But more fundamentally, we tend to turn a blind eye to the centrality of this form of human exploitation in ancient politics. There's a collusion to worship at the wellsprings of Athenian democracy without noticing that slavery was one of its crucial components, without seeing that ancient liberty was built on ancient slavery. And Ted, instead we tend to think of it as a kind of an unfortunate epiphenomenon, and you know it's worked on by people who are specialists in ancient slavery when it ought to be central. And somehow I think we're used to looking at the ancient world, most of us, without facing it. And how do we do that? Well, we repeatedly domesticate it. Now, I don't mean always to be picking on the Cambridge Latin course, but the treatment of Grumio, the slave cook, the sometimes good-humoured, sometimes grumpy household retainer, is a good example. Here you see him in his kitchen, and here on the right with one of his mates. Now, the Latin phrase underneath, the slaves were happy, has recently caused some raised eyebrows. Now, I have to say, I think it would be equally misleading to say that, you know, the slaves were always miserable. You know, it being a kind of amazing capacity of the human spirit to be happy in the most unlikely circumstances. And I'm sure that slaves were not always misery. There is, however, a sense that to give our young Latin learners this version of slavery, which is what the Cambridge Latin course does, not the beaten verses of slavery or the version or the minds, is to give them only one small bit of the story. Grumio, I don't know if anybody watches ITV2's Plebs series, Grumio the Slave has a whole new life in a new television series in which he's equally like he is on in the Cambridge Latin course. So we domesticate it, we make it nice, household retainer kind of stuff. We also translate slavery away, like we translate rape away. We say abducted, not rape. And I think one of the striking things about Emily Wilson's recent translation of the Odyssey is that she was pretty much the first, I think not the first, but pretty much the first, to translate the woman slaves in Odysseus's household, many of whom get killed in the end, not as handmaidens, as they are conventionally translated, but as slaves. But we, and this is to finish with, are also the followers of the ancients in the comfortable narrative, like in Plebs and like here, of the comic and clever slave, who, despite his or her position in the hierarchy, always gets the better of the stupid old master. Now, I don't know how many people in the audience remember Frankie Howard as the slave Lurkio, extremely camp slave Lurkio, obviously, shown on primetime television in Up Pompeii in the 60s and early 70s. I remember watching this with absolute hilarity, week by week, and I saw nothing in it at all other than the rather gratifying triumph of the underdog. Now, it seems to me that that is one of the problems that we have in looking at slavery, not one of the solutions. Thank you.
Okay, now we have time for some questions. If you want to ask a question, then put up your hand, as this gentleman has done here, and wait until the cordless mic comes to you. Thank you. Gentleman here.
Hello?
It works.
Now, it's very confusing what I'm going to ask.
Oh, no. But,
sometimes I think to the slaves in Rome. I'm Roman, but I live here from 22 years, so I'm also a British citizen now. But when I think to Rome, when you say about slavery in Rome, you make me think about Petronius. Petronius, he wrote about Trimalchion, the famous Cena Trimalchionis. Yeah. So Trimalchion was probably a Syrian slave that he was, he became a freedman. So in the Satyricon of Petronius, I think we are talking about 120 Anno Domine. He became so extremely rich that I think he's probably, a person that becoming so rich, he was so able to invite everyone at his dinner. And it was quite probably, maybe he was teasing, Petroni was teasing this person for his dreadful bad taste. So I think he's probably one off, can I say something? Or also talking about Juvenalis. Juvenalis, he detests women, and he was a misogynist, and he detested Greek people. They were talking about Greek influence. Anyway, what do you think about this, what is called in this country?
Satyricon.
The hostile environment in Rome.
Hostile environment, gosh.
Thank you.
I've always thought, I have come to think that the Petronius Satyricon and the portrayal of an ex-slave who's made it very, very rich is another one of those cases where we're seeing the ambivalence about slavery and particularly the transformation of the status of slave to free man. Really paraded, because Trimalchion's got a whole load of money, and part of the point of the Satyricon is to show how this ex-slave is always getting it wrong. You know, it's always a bit naff, it's a bit vulgar, it's a bit something, you know, it's kind of, I'm sorry if there's a Premier Division football player here, but it's kind of, he's a bit like what a really, really well, you know, it's a bit like the Beckhams, you know, with having thrones and things like that, you know, and you think, gosh, this is, you know, this is so naff, it shows, you know, you can't be, you know, it has no breeding, no taste. What is always a good question, though, after you've read a load of pages and pages of this kind of Trimalchion's excess, the question you always have to ask students when they're reading is, if you were invited to dinner by Trimalchion, would you go? And the answer is always yes. So you've got that, you know, like we would go to, you know, the Palazzo Beckham, wouldn't we, if we were asked? You know, so there's a kind of, our kind of relationship to that, to getting it right, getting it wrong, is very, very complicated. The joke is not always on Trimalchion, it's partly on us. Mm-hmm, yeah. Ooh, gold-plated taps, how vulgar.
Yes. Here comes the mic.
First of all, I have to say, and I'm sure I speak from everyone, that we are all your pupils. You give so magnificent a mixture of education and entertainment, which is what education should always be. And it is so delightful for us to see that you do it in the lecture theatre with the same extraordinary skill that you do in your writings.
Thank you. And now that's the prequel. That's the. Thank you. And now a killer question is about to come.
I wondered what you thought of the Confession of St. Patrick as a slave narrative coming from a Romanized world, although not at that point, still a part of the Roman Empire.
I mean, that's what I think the problem is. I mean, I have to say it's about 20 years since I read the Confession of St. Patrick, so do not imagine that I am deeply familiar. I have read it a long time ago. I think the problem is, for me, is that I can... the kind of narratives that I'm looking at they get their edge and their difficulty because they are embedded in that, in the centrality of slavery to the political institutions of the, certainly the Greek city-state, but also in different ways to the Roman polity. Now, that, as I recall it, is that is not what gives that narrative the edge. Whereas for, you know, Hadrian versus his slave and the eye, it is about that, it's the symbiotic quality which makes it, which drives the ambiguity. And I don't think you have that in that, or in later, I mean, there's an awful lot of attempts to say, rightly, I think, to want to see this classical Roman slavery within a comparative tradition, and, you know, all to the good in many ways. But there seems to be a fundamental difference always, that is not how any of those later cultures, whether, you know, going right up to antebellum America, it's lacking one terribly important building block.
Any other questions? There's somebody up here. Oh, and there.
You want one of those balls? Those, you know, the microphone.
Or I'll get them in line in sequence.
Thank you. When you were talking about the paradox of everything that Athena represents, and the exclusion of women from politics, which I know wasn't the focus of the lecture. I'm going to ask anyway.
I had to put a bit about women in.
Yeah. I was wondering how the Athenians could reconcile the later necessity of an Athenian mother, but the exclusion of Athenian women.
Really, it's really interesting, and I start that from the, I'm talking about my own mum now. You know, you go up to the Acropolis and you say, and she says, not only knowing a little bit about what you've told her about Athens, she said, but you said that it was all terribly misogynistic, and yet they've got their patron goddess is a woman, right? That doesn't add up to me. And it's a good point. And so, I think I would just read it absolutely literally. I think what that is... that statue is saying, and what the stories that are told and retold about Athena are telling you, is that if the world was perfect, we wouldn't have women. You know, and there's quite a lot of cultures and myths which make that leap. And so I think that what it does, given that we know that actually the job of the woman was having the babies and breeding all this stuff, I think what it does is repeatedly tells women that they're that they are not just second best in that they haven't got voting rights or whatever, that in a perfect world they wouldn't exist. It's a kind of way of saying if things were better, we'd do without you. And when you look at that statue, if you're a woman, you don't think, well, it's nice to know that the men folk come and they worship the women. No, you just think, that is so shocking, it's not me. And if I read it right, it's saying it's not you, and actually it's showing that things would be better if you weren't here. And there's plenty in both Greek and other mythologies which make that point. The Athenians are extremely vulgar in displaying it. Do go to Nashville, it's amazing.
Thank you.
Someone right up at the back there. So wait until the mic comes, because we can't hear you.
Just to pick up on the interesting question and interesting answer about St. Patrick, Christian philosophy abolishing the distinction between master and slave, and
I recall
a Tom Holland TV documentary about St. Paul some years ago, in which Tom Holland proposes St. Paul as someone who, from Christian philosophy, challenges the distinction between master and slave, and as Jew and Gentile, etc. I just wonder what your thoughts might be.
I mean, there are people who know about the literature of the early church in this room in much greater intimate detail than I do. But what I would say, insofar as I've thought about that, which I obviously have a bit, because you do have to think, where does this institution get challenged? I mean, what's absolutely clear is that, and I didn't talk about this, but because we didn't have time, but another section that I would have liked to put in is that slavery, first I'll talk about pagan, but then in pagan writing, slavery is absolutely embedded as an image, as a metaphor, in Roman literature and Greek literature across the board. Right? It's you can't think about yourself. You know, this is real, I suppose, kind of ancient intersectionality. You can't think about yourself in the world without thinking about slavery as one of the ways of seeing the relationship between you and anybody else. So the obvious example of that would be in Latin love poetry, when what is the relationship of the man to his desired woman? It's servitium, it's slavery. Right? Now, how does Pliny address the Emperor Trajan when he's writing to him? Domine, right? Which is the word for master. Now, you know, Pliny would be absolutely horrified at the idea that he was putting himself in the position of a slave, but that kind of, that the definition of that hierarchy is absolutely embedded in how you talk about your relationship with anybody else, higher, lower, etc. And it seems to me that although it's sometimes in a different modality, that really Christianity inherits that rather than overturns it. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go to the question of why does ancient slavery end, most of the people, and I'm happy to hear from the experts, most of the people that I've read about that, you know, by the time we're getting into the early Middle Ages, see it as economic, not moral. And Christianity, it seems to me, is using in the pre-6, you know, up to Augustine, is using and sometimes subverting, but it's using the building blocks for talking about status, hierarchy, wealth, etc., that will be deeply recognisable, though sometimes twisted. From any pagan discourse, whether that's children or, it does actually start to have a debate about poverty in a way which pagan literature doesn't, but also slavery, that it's using the terms. But as I say, I'm not... That is what I think.
Any comment on that?
Let's hear from the experts, come on. Never talk about slavery with a load of theologians.
Any further questions?
I guess we have a drink.
Well, I think we have to say thank you very much indeed,
thank
Professor
you.
Beard.